Welcome into the All Ball Podcast, a great part of the Herd Podcast Network. I'm Doug Gottlieb, your host. And, hey, do us a favor. When you're done, subscribe to the All Ball Podcast and rate us. It helps us. I don't make any extra money off it, although maybe eventually I will. But more importantly, it kind of helps. It helps my bosses feel good about what we're doing here. Rashad Phillips will join us. If you don't remember Rashad Phillips, you don't remember 90s and early 2000 basketball. He was a star, all-time leading scorer, University of Detroit. Scored over 2,300 points. Get his kind of unique perspective on some of the players still playing and getting ready in the NCAA tournament and get ready for the NBA draft. Oh, yeah, Bill Self. Oh, yeah, Porter Mosier, also part of the All Ball Podcast this week. Got about, 7 or 8 minutes with both of them. I think you'll enjoy. We'll get you ready for the Final Four. I think the other thing we're going to do as we will transition from the Final Four in college basketball and some of the coaching changes, we'll continue to bring you some great stories of college basketball coaches. What I want to do in the coming All Ball Podcast is bring on some of these coaches, and you'll find out about them as people, them about their upbringing, where they played growing up, who they played for, and how they formed kind of their basketball opinions, if you will, as well as what their program's like today. So we're going to continue focusing on college, but then we'll transition more to NBA. Get ready for the NBA playoffs. Have on NBA guests. You'll find out about some of these injuries and about the future of some NBA stars, as free agency is also interesting. And we'll get you ready for the NBA draft. So we'll do a little bit of all that today. Look, we're weeks away from the NBA playoffs, which I do think are going to be exhilarating. I'm not buying all these guys being hurt. I think everybody's just trying to get completely rested, completely healthy. And as much as Steph Curry's knee tweak looked bad, and the MCL, it can hurt your lateral movement, the fact is that when Steph says, I'll be back for a week for game one of the playoffs, I feel like he's more hurt than injured. You know, if you don't have surgery on your knee and you just sprain your knee, I think you're going to be okay. I do. And KD, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, to me, the whole question with them is going to be their bench. But I look around the league, John Wall is going to be back. I don't know about Kyrie, but I'd assume he'd be back as well. People freak out about a scope of your knee. The more you've been in it, if you have your knee scoped and cleaned up, you can play a week or a couple weeks later. He'll have time to rest. I don't know. I just, maybe it's me being hopeful, but I get the sense you'll see Kawhi, you'll see LaMarcus, you'll see all these guys that are banged up and nicked up actually get clean and healthy, and we'll have a much more exciting playoffs this year than we had last year. I think the East is closer to LeBron and the Cavs than they've been. And I think the West, I'm still not a buyer long-term into Houston if Golden State's healthy, but I think Oklahoma City's interesting. San Antonio, if healthy, is interesting. Minnesota's interesting. Portland, they've been incredible. Even at the defensive end in the second half of the season, they're interesting. New Orleans is interesting. Man, playing better without DeMarcus Cousins. Who could have saw that coming? Actually, I think a lot of people. Anyway, we'll get you ready for the NBA playoffs and the NBA draft and bring you some of the draft potential draftees on this show. So we'll do we'll cast a wide swath, if you will. But let's focus on the Final Four. I guess I should be surprised, but the fact is, and if you've listened to the Doug Gottlieb Show, which you can listen to 3 to 6 Eastern Time on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or XM Sirius Channel 83 daily, it's 12 to 3 Pacific, you know that before the tournament, I said, no matter how chaotic it seems at the time, we usually get three teams you kind of expect to get in and one team that's kind of a Cinderella. We've had that a lot of time. I've been to so many of these Final Fours, and that's what we have this year. And you have Loyola Chicago, who did win their league tournament, got in and won their first three games by four points, and, of course, end up dominating in the Elite Eight, and now they're playing for the right to play for a national championship. I don't think it's a particularly good matchup between them and Michigan, not just because of Wagner, but Wagner is a big part. He's just so much. One of the differences in low-major, mid-major, high-major basketball is not just the size of players, and obviously some of that has changed, not just with kind of there being a much more gray area between high and mid-major basketball, but also with so many high-major guys going early to the pros. But the biggest thing has been the quality of big player. And Wagner from Michigan, as a stretch five that can also defend the rim and score a little bit around the bucket, I think that presents the biggest threat to Loyola. In addition to which, though they're not all as old as Loyola's players, you got a more veteran team with Michigan than you would have with some other high majors. And then in the other semifinal, I do like Villanova over Kansas, and I think one of the things is this is probably Kansas' weakest group in terms of NBA caliber talent. Like, I look at that roster and like, who's gonna? Is Malik Newman an NBA player? Maybe. Is he a first round draft pick? I don't think so. Udoka Azubuike, one, I don't know how he plays in this guy. He can't guard Amari Spellman out at the 3-point line, and even though he can score at the low post, he can't. There's too many possessions which he can't play defensively because he doesn't have the wind for it, and he doesn't play that long when he plays. This is arguably NBA talent-wise the least talented per se team Bill Self has ever had, and yet here they are, chance to play for a national championship, going up against the Villanova team that I think matches up with them really, really well. I do think they have more NBA players than they had when they won the national championship 2 years ago. And it's pretty fascinating, the evolution of Jay Wright as a basketball coach. You know, Jay Wright went from, hey, let's just play a take-em offense and really pressure defensively. And then they went through years where they weren't very good defensively at all. And then he kind of just rewired, reformulated himself, and they become a dynamic defensive team. That's the one thing that all three of these teams, four of these teams have in common. They're tremendously well-coached at the defensive end. I actually think they're really well-coached altogether. And it's funny that you'll hear people say about Bill Self, he doesn't get the respect he deserves. He's in the Hall of Fame. I don't know how much more respect you can give a guy. I think John Beilein eventually will be in the Hall of Fame. And I think the same can be said for Jay Wright, whether he wins the second national title this week or not. What he's putting together at Villanova through 17 years, but especially the last 5 years, an absolute juggernaut. They are the new beast of the Big East. Speaking of the Big East, a couple of news and news nuggets before we get you off to Rashad Phillips and Bill Self and Porter Mosier. I think what's fascinating about Chris Mack going to Louisville is there's still a gap. There's still a gap between the new Big East and the ACC. And while you may not see it because you say, hey, Xavier had a one seed, Virginia had a one seed. Virginia lost in the first round. Xavier lost in the second round or whatever. Okay. And Villanova's a one seed and they're still playing. The difference is this. Generally the caliber of athlete out of high school to the ACC is generally better. Now, it was down this year with North Carolina, and I think some of that is they've had guys leave early for the draft, but a lot of it is the fact that people didn't know if they were going to be on probation until they weren't on probation. Virginia lost, three players to transfer last season. Their talent was a little bit down. Syracuse is like a year away. Louisville lost their most talented incoming recruit and their coach. And Louisville still had some premier talent. So Wake Forest is like a year away. Pittsburgh has completely had to remake itself. So the league for the ACC is down. But keep in mind that if you're Chris Mack, you're taking on in Louisville, whoever you recruit to play at Louisville is now going to have to play against Duke, Carolina, Virginia, Syracuse, the athletes of Florida State. Like, that's a game in, game out. And so while I understand, I think the quality of play in the Big East has been very, very good. You have a lot of older teams, a lot of teams with transfers, the Creightons of the world. Providence, if Emmett Holt had played, he'll play next year as a six-year senior. The fact is that it's a little bit higher caliber of league in the ACC as opposed to the Big East, and it's obviously a much better paying job. I think he's going to double his money. That's why Chris Mack leaves, but that's why it becomes a bigger challenge. And then you look behind at Xavier, and I see so many people saying, hey, Travis Steele is the easy solution to being the head coach, and it probably is the easy solution. He has, earned the chance as the associate head coach to become the head coach at Xavier. But remember, this is a different Xavier than A-10 Xavier. This is Big East number one seed Xavier. There are much bigger challenges, And they've been, frankly, recruiting a higher caliber of athlete over the last 5 years than they recruited previously when they were winning A-10 titles. So I think both jobs, only an hour and a half apart, one league apart, and you've seen so many coaches make the jump from Xavier to Wake Forest, to Providence, to Arizona, etc. To Ohio State, that I think you believe that Xavier will survive, and they probably will, and yet Chris Mack has been so good at Xavier, you would assume he'll be good at Louisville, and he probably will. But there are different calibers of jobs, different levels of challenges, and I think that Travis Steele, if he inherits Xavier's program, it's a more difficult job than than when Chris Mack took it over. And Chris Mack, following in the footsteps of Rick Pitino, who had been to Final Fours and won a national championship at Louisville, that's a harder job than what you had at Xavier, where you had your culture intact through various head coaches. I think that part of it is absolutely fascinating. We also have free agency season in college basketball, and the rating of the low and mid-majors continues, the plethora of transfers. And I know that some of you listening to this are basketball people, and basketball people, you're nodding your head. You're going like, look, it's a problem. Right? The reason that Kansas doesn't have a bench is kid doesn't play, I want to transfer, even if it's during his freshman year. That's what Tubby Smith was talking about. He's not talking about the idea of transferring. Like, look, if you play somewhere 2 years and they recruit over you and you're not going to start, you go and you say, coach, am I going to have a bigger role next year? You're like, not really. No, we think we have somebody. Then you transfer and nobody's harmed by it. But nine games into your freshman year, or simply because you're not willing to bide your time, even though that was what was told you would do when you signed at a place, I think that's what's changed in terms of culture-wise in basketball. But you combine just the plethora of transfers with the fifth-year, sixth-year grad school transfers, and it's out-and-out free agency. You know, it's I had a high major assistant say, like, who was in the Big Ten, and he was like, look, we're off for the last week of championship week. We almost feel like sending a guy out to watch mid-major tournaments to recruit, because that's what everybody's doing, is recruiting these grad transfers. And there are lists floating around. I'm sure many of you have them, of guys that can graduate this summer so they can transfer and play right away. I think as so many of you are basketball coaches, travel to San Antonio for the NABC convention, like, if you're going to adjust anything, there's got to be an adjustment made, because I get that if a kid graduates on time, he should be rewarded. And if the reward is he gets to play elsewhere, that's cool. But think about it, if you're the college coach and I recruited you, I sat you for your first year, I started you your second year, your third year, you're an all-league player, I depended upon you coming back, and then you walk into my office, you're like, coach, love you, but I'm going to go transfer up to play in the Big Ten, the Pac-12, the Big 12, et cetera, et cetera. Like, is that really the spirit of what we're doing? You can transfer, but there has to be some sort of penalty. Whether it's even as a grad transfer, you sit out and play one, so you can have, you know, you can play 4 years. If you redshirted a year because of injury or because you redshirted early in your career, you should still have to sit out an additional year. That way you get your master's degree, right? You should be progressing to it. If you want a grad transfer, you should have to sit and get your degree. Here's the last thing, and I think this is something so many of you know me to be about. Is not just coaches getting opportunities that are about the right thing, but teams being about the right thing. And I think we are being rewarded with coaches that coach the right way, teams that play the right way. But I don't think we should be the end-all, be-all, be the Final Four. And by that, I mean, take a look at Purdue and what that team accomplished. Didn't win a Big Ten title this year, didn't win a Big Ten tournament. Isaac Haas gets hurt. Otherwise, they match up with Xavier. It would have been incredibly interesting to me. I do think they would have won and met up with Xavier. I had them beating Xavier. The point is that those seniors, and there's essentially five of them, four that played huge minutes, changed the culture of the place. I've said this time and again about Kansas. When Kansas wins a double round robin Big 12 year after year with all the pressure, whether they make the NCAA, make the Final Four or not, they've still had a great year. There's such a depth of teams that had great years that suffered a terrible or gut-wrenching loss. Look at Tennessee, right? Tennessee, you come from behind, you take the lead, you probably, if you're not messing around, you should beat Loyola of Chicago. And Clayton Custer goes one-on-one, shoots front rim, ball hits the front rim, then back rim, then up and in. That's how you lose. That doesn't mean Tennessee didn't have an incredible season under Rick Barnes. Even Auburn that gets blown out. Think about Auburn loses two starters to start the year and a third starter during the year. They end up winning the SEC. I thought Bruce Pearl and Auburn had a spectacular year. Harvard won the Ivy League. Didn't win the Ivy League tournament. That's played on campus at Penn at the Palestra. They had a big-time year. I guess there should be some portion of us that, and maybe that's where this show is, to where we can talk about some of the programs that accomplished incredible things, even if they weren't during the NCAA tournament. Because the NCAA tournament sometimes can cast a pale over our eyes to where we assume a team had a great year when really they didn't. Syracuse didn't have a great year. They didn't. They got in the NCAA tournament. They won a couple games, very smartly playing a shortened game by slowing the pace and playing their zone defense. But you finish below 500 in your league, no one should be happy. But you shouldn't, especially at a place like Syracuse. And look, I was an advocate for Oklahoma State being in ahead of Oklahoma. But Oklahoma State lost 15 games in the season. Like, that's not a great year. It might be surprising to some because so many people didn't know what Mike Boynton was capable of, and they were picked last or next to last in most polls. But that doesn't mean you had a great year. That means you had a surprising year. Great years are years in which you massively overachieve, or you win your league, or you come close to winning your league, in-balance league, and win your league tournament. You're playing good ball going to the NCAA tournament. So there are teams. I thought Kansas State had a very good year. Very good year. Not just because they're playing the NCAA tournament, but, you know, your point guard goes down midway through the Big 12, and you actually play as well or play better after that injury. With that in mind, let's get to some of our special guests on All Ball. Let's welcome in Porter Mosier, head coach of Cinderella, Loyola Chicago. And, Porter, it's interesting. I've actually come to learn a lot about Loyola, not because of watching your team, but talking to other athletic directors. Like, hey, did you know that they built the beach on campus? Did you know that the school itself is starting to take students from other private schools? And now all of a sudden, like, the student body is expanding. When you first got to Loyola, what was the place like? What was the tenor of the university?
Well, athletics was the 29th topic that would come up when you talked about Loyola. It wasn't part of who we were. And that's it's an unbelievable academic school. It's gorgeous. They put so much into the campus. It's on the lake. I can see out my window and see Lake Michigan right here. And so that part of it. And so the grind of to go from where literally there was hardly anybody in the stands and to see all the videos go viral of this run and see the Chicago skyline lit up, go Loyola. It's been so, you know, cool, rewarding, especially for me being from Chicago. And it's just the buzz, the energy. I think it's going to change the direction of this university forever.
So does that mean you're going to stay? You know how this thing works. You become the hot coach, and now all of a sudden job after job gets thrown. You're now a genius. How do you process the conversation about whether or not it's a long term fit?
You know, that conversation obviously will happen after this run. I mean, I think the school has reached out and, you know, expressed that they want to discuss that, and I'm grateful for that. But I've just kind of been, you know, I've told my guys to block out distractions, and I'm doing the same thing. And it just our focus has been so much driven on what's ahead of us. And, you know, I know that will come up and become a reality after this weekend. We'll have to, you know, see that when the time happens.
What did you – I know you've talked about Illinois State and talked about going to work for Rick and about how that all kind of just worked and brought you home to Chicago, and this has been a great fit in – now you've been able to accomplish things that coaches only dream of accomplishing. What did you learn most from what happened at Illinois State?
You know, just that adversity doesn't have to define you. You can get better from it. And, you know, I've gotten better from it. It's made me more, you know, who I am and you know, knowing that I can respond through things that don't go our way. It's helped me, you know, and that's why I like talking to other coaches that happen to. I always try to call guys that I know that had gone through, because the next step, you're going to go through a grieving any time in life, whatever adversity is. That's kind of normal. But the next step, this reinvention, You can use your competitiveness and your energy to reinvent yourself. And I remember I had a chance to get a really crappy low job as a head coach. And I'm like, do I really want to do that just to prove people that I'm doing this? Or I had a chance to go work with Rick Majerus. And I chose that, more humbling. I've been a head coach in two different stops. But it was all about getting better, and I felt I got better. And then it's, you know, you get confidence the more you bounce back from adversity. Because I'm going to have it again. I guarantee you I'll have it again. And you just keep grinding for the reinvention is a next competitive part of your journey.
All right, so now you have Michigan, and you have a coach's coach. You know, a guy who everyone in the business respects looking down the other sideline, not just at the way he does it, doing it the right way in John Beilein, but also the way in which his team plays. Is there a parallel to this type of challenge in terms of the style of play, the preparation for the style of play, based upon who you've competed against this season?
You know, Coach Beilein's one of the best in our profession. And like you said, everyone knows it. And he's doing it again. They're on a hot streak as well. They haven't lost in a while, running through the Big Ten tournament. And, you know, they pose some matchup problems because Mo Wagner, he's just different. You know, he's different because he's a big that can stretch you. He can shoot it. When he sets those pistol screens, he sets those lane line pistol screens, and he drops up. He'll do the pistol screen and short roll. He'll pick and pop. You have to make decisions on ball screens. You have to do some things. And then their guards. I mean, guards can really go downhill. They can really go downhill, so you got to contain that. And then there's just not a lot of teams, especially that we've played, that has, a 6'11 guy that can stretch you at a high level from three.
But Cameron's been really impressive. I mean, for a freshman to be competing at this high level and be that solid, when did you first see him?
I saw him when he was a sophomore, and I just loved that he was a basketball player. And, you know, I think people at the next level, you know, and I get it, people look at his athleticism, and he's not a rim protector. He's not a high-flying guy above the rim, which on a side note, Doug, I think we have to be the first team in Division I history to go to the Final Four and not have a dunk in the NCAA tournament as of yet.
That's amazing. That's an incredible stat.
But Crutley knows who he is. You know, he's not a shot blocker. He's a throw-you-to-the-rim guy. He's a rotate over, be big. He's a take space up. And offensively, he isn't too sped up. A lot of freshmen are so sped up. And the NBA guys always say that about the college guys. You know, we're too sped up and everything. He's beyond his years in the post. He's not sped up. He takes his time. He pivots. He kind of waits to see what side you're leaning towards, and he kind of spins back. He's got a great pace to himself in the paint.
Is there a way in which you can prepare the players so that you know the moment's not too big? Is there anything that you've been able to kind of figure out you want to – because, look, it's even one thing to practice, obviously, in front of, you know, 30, 40,000 people. It's a whole other thing to play that game. What in your preparation do you think you can do to prepare them for when they have that big moment on the floor at the Alamo Dome so that it's not too big?
Well, there's nothing I can simulate that's going to be like this. I mean, I think each step, each regional in Dallas and this, there's been a ton of hype. So they've responded to all that. But I tell you, Doug, the one thing, I've reached out to some other coaches and I've asked them about it. And the things that come back to me, everyone says, try to be as normal as you can with your routine. Normal with your meals, normal with your walkthroughs, normal with your film sessions. Try to take it as normal. The second thing, which was great advice, they're like, put a deadline on Tuesday. Your tickets are in. No more changing it. Because of the distractions of people reaching out for tickets, some people said the first time they went, it went all the way to like Friday. And it can be so so we did it. I mean, by 8 o'clock today, there's no changing their ticket list, none, and they're not going to deal with that. So it's just interesting to see people say the distractions, you try to limit them as much as you can to try to get to stay normal.
Is there in preparing for Michigan, everyone worries about their offense. This year's team is really, really good defensively. How do you balance the time in terms of, you know, coaches all want to get the great scouting report to shut down John Beilein's offense. On the other hand, their defense is really their calling card. How do you prepare for that?
You really have to watch it because they're so well coached and on all of it. I mean, they're big. They hedge ball screens. They low lateral ball screens. They got, you know, their guards are 6'4", 6'6", 6'7". You know, Simpson, their point guard, absolutely gets after you at the point. And it is such a good point, Doug, because they, you know, you do, when you think of Coach Beilein, you think of how much they execute and the efficiency on offense, but they're at the top of their game defensively, and that's what makes them so good.
Was there a moment in any of those first three games where you thought it wasn't going to happen?
No, because it was so close. You're not just sitting there, it's not going to happen. It wasn't like we were down 10 with a minute left and had a comeback. They were right there, you know, and so I really never felt it wasn't going to happen. Grateful as hell some of the couple of shots went in. You know, Dante Ingram hit a big-time shot, and you know, in there, and we didn't call timeout in that Miami game, and, you know, we our guys kind of practiced the attack, and because so many things can happen when you call a timeout. You know, looking back on all of it, you'll start to, you know, think about how it was. But our guys have been in the moment, Doug. They really have embraced it.
What would it mean for you to be playing on Monday night?
It's your ultimate goal. I mean, you dream as when you first get into this, you dream as a kid to play in it. You dream as a coach to get to that stage. And trust me, there's thankfulness is on my mind 24/7. Blessed to be at this position. And just don't want it to end. And our guys don't want it to end.
Well, listen, you have most of the free world rooting for you. And it's one of those things where people, I think, even feel bad about rooting against Beilein. But Sister Jean obviously makes that pill easier to swallow. she's become a national symbol of hope. And it's really kind of remarkable what's taken place.
It has.
Wish you nothing but success. Safe travels to San Antonio, and thanks for joining us.
You can listen to my radio show, 3 to 6 Eastern, noon to 3 Pacific, Monday through Friday on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, the SiriusXM Channel 83. I had Kansas head coach Bill Self on to talk about their run to the Final Four.
There's a picture of you, Bill, kind of celebrating and yelling to the sky and the crowd going crazy in the background. How big was it for you emotionally to win that game?
It was big. It was huge. It was a, you know, you get a chance to play Duke, you know, on the biggest stage, you know, in the most important game of the season thus far, and certainly, you know, for the Rice to go to a Final Four, and you know, we've been knocked out in the Elite Eight the last 2 years, so yeah, it was big. It was big. It was somewhat emotional, I guess, for everybody, but I thought we played great. I thought we played at a pretty high level the entire game, as I thought they did as well, but certainly our guys made some unbelievable plays down the stretch.
I thought maybe, and this part hasn't been discussed enough, which is I thought your guys did a great job of executing the scouting report at times defensively. Case in point, Grayson Allen gets the ball isolated last play of regulation, and yeah, he nearly made a bank shot, but it's because you took away his right hand. You played him to spin back to the left, exactly as the scouting report is written. It's one thing to write it down. It's another team to get the team to lock in and execute like that.
Yeah, I thought we did it. You know, Grayson, you know, as he's hard to guard, especially when you're in the bonus, because he can put pressure on you, and he's such a great free throw shooter. But Malik did a good job on him. I mean, he scored 12, but he got three with no time left at the end of the game, and he got three on a switch early in the game. But so when Malik was locked in on him, he did a great job, and certainly I thought Sfi did a great job on Bagley, even though he still got some numbers. I you know, he limited his good touches and certainly did a pretty admirable job of keeping him off the offensive glass.
You know, you mentioned Malik. There was a time early in the year, I'll admit it, I was ready to bail on the kid. You know, I just thought, all right, a year off after an up and down freshman year at Mississippi State, maybe he's just not that good. Did you ever think he just ain't good enough?
No, I never thought he wasn't good enough. Never, never, never. I thought he was playing under his ability, though. I think if this is his ability, I thought he performed under that. You know, the vast majority of our season this year, and I don't know why. Just trying to fit in or deferring or not wanting to screw up. But in the last 3 weeks or so, he's become, you know, arguably as good a guard as there is in the country. I mean, he's been on. He's played at a really high level, and being MVP of our conference tournament, and probably as good a player as there was in Wichita, and the most outstanding player in Omaha. You know, he's been on a great, great role, and we've needed him. And you know, because Devontae has played well, but he hadn't made shots yet. So hopefully, when we get those two clicking, and with Sfi and LeGerald, you know, hopefully making shots, you know, will be much harder to guard. But I think Malik's been terrific.
I think it's been just as a friend and a fan, it's been a remarkable year. I mean, to go through what you went through with the roster changes midseason, to add Silvio, you know, midseason, like, who does that, right? I mean, who does that? And yet you win the league, you win the tournament, you win the league tournament, you win two in Wichita and win two hard-fought ones in Nebraska. Like, this has been an incredible year. I know you won it in San Antonio last time. Is it fair to say this might be a more remarkable year?
You know what? The team in San Antonio in 08 was – I mean, that was a year, you remember, Doug, that all four number one seeds made it. I mean, there were real pros. I mean, you know, playing, you know, when you got, you know, of course, Rose and all that crew with Memphis, and you got, you know, Kevin Love and all those guys, I believe Westbrook at UCLA, and you know, Ty Lawson and Hansbrough and Ellington and Danny Green or whoever. I mean, there were some real guys in that, plus our guys. So we were one of the best four teams in the country all year long that year. This year we haven't been. This year we've been hit and miss, and we've been pretty soft at times. And certainly, you know, the things that we kind of take great pride in here, we haven't been great at. Our first shot defense was average, and we rebounded it poorly for the vast majority of the season. But we kind of got it turned a little bit, and then, you know, how we won the game the other day was basically, you know, winning the battle of the boards by 15. And so I was really pleased to see that. And, you know, the whole thing with me is, and with most coaches, I think, you know, you're not going to play well all the time, but you got to make sure other teams play bad. And we haven't done that consistently. And I'm not saying we did that against Duke because they played well and had a good game. It was just we're just getting better in those intangible areas.
You know, it's interesting. You're going to match up with Villanova, very physical team. Obviously, one
very physical.
I mean, unbelievably physical. And somehow they don't get called for fouls, 38th in fouls. In college basketball, but you're going to play them essentially playing four guards, which is something that many would say they popularized. Like, there is an irony to your four-guard attack going against Villanova to play for a national championship.
Well, I think, you know, Villanova can play five guards too. You know, whenever Spellman comes out of the game and they're playing Pascal at the five, I mean, that's a you know, even though he's, you know, he's probably a three in nature, I mean, his true position, but that's hard to guard. And then their five man, as you know, may be their best percentage three-point shooter right now.
Yeah.
So they're a hard team to guard. I read today they're seven threes away from being the having the most threes made in a season in the history of college ball. So, and even though that one only goes back 30 years, that's still a remarkable stat, because you think it'd be some run and gun team that averaged 100 a game that would do that. So, they're good, and they're averaging 86 a game, but they may even be better defensively than they are offensively, and certainly they're as well coached as anybody in the country. So, we know we got our hands full, but we're so looking forward to it.
Do you remember the last time? Are there any Are there any things that you're going to emulate that you did last time?
The last time we played Villanova?
No, the last time you were at the Final Four in San Antonio and you won it.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, it's we may bring something up with our guys, or, you know, may call something out, but I don't think so. This is the first time, obviously, for this group going, and very few of us were actually a part of this. I guess myself and Townsend and the trainers, you know, and the strength coach, and that's about it. So this is going to be totally new. But I don't know if we can draw from anything from that to help us, just because it's in the same city. But certainly, hopefully, you know, there will be a little bit of subconscious confidence level going in, knowing we've had some success down there before.
All right, man. Well, listen, we know we'll see some out of bounds plays, the alley oops, especially if they go to a zone. That's a staple. And we know we'll have you challenging your team to not be soft in the sideline.
Thanks, Doug.
All right, we continue here on the All Ball podcast with a special guest. He has his own digital show, and, of course, he's a college basketball guru. He's the University of Detroit's all-time leading scorer. He scored 2,319 points. That's why he calls his show 2319. He's Rashad Phillips. He joins us here on All Ball. Rashad, what's up, man?
Hey, Doug, how you doing?
I'm great. You texted me as soon as Loyola won in the Elite Eight they're going to beat Michigan. Why?
This is a team that they've been winning all season long. And if you look at the NCAA tournament, it's about matchups. Michigan's a three-point shooting team. Loyola is a team that specializes off running teams off of the three-point line. So we've witnessed Loyola do that to a lot of teams thus far, and Michigan is just going to have a long night trying to get those jump shots against a team like Loyola.
I guess the problem is, how do they match up with Wagner, right? I mean, Wagner is a guy who can score inside but also can stretch you out. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the matchup with Wagner specifically.
Well, I think Wagner is the X factor here in regards to his versatility, his ability to stretch the defense, go inside, and he's just a high cerebral type of player. But when you're Loyola, you have to give up something, and I believe that unit will not try to stop Wagner, but what they will do is limit the rest of the guys around him.
Rashad Phillips joining us. Look, I'll give you full credit. You saw this Loyola thing coming before anybody else. What about their What about the personnel did you see before anybody else?
Well, what I studied is, a lot of times when we look at college basketball, we try to find a storyline to fit these mid-major teams instead of just being completely objective and cover the name and just look at the stats and look at the kids. I watched them on film early on, and what you're looking at is seven kids that won state championships in high school. So you're looking at a team full of winners. This unit is used to winning games. They defend well. They don't make a lot of mistakes. Their starting five all shoot above 45%. So we're looking at a high, efficient, well-oiled machine that's been doing this for 6 months.
All right, let's go to Kansas taking on Villanova. I see this matchup, and look, I do think Kansas can stretch him out, and I think Kansas can make shots. But outside of running a fever and hitting a bunch of threes, I love the matchup for Villanova. What say you?
Yeah, I actually like the matchup. I think Villanova is just the more complete team from top to bottom. Again, high efficiency, and I believe point guard play will come into play here. Jalen Brunson is tremendous. Devontae Graham has kind of figured out how to play that point guard position, but I believe a guy like Brunson has been bred to play this position on this type of stage. I think he wins that battle.
Rashad Phillips joining us. Okay, so one of the other things you do is you like to forecast NBA talent on your own digital show, which, of course, you can follow Rashad on Twitter as well. Let's start with Trae Young. Now, you've been saying Trae Young to the Orlando Magic since, I think, like the first week of the season.
Yeah.
I'm high on Trae Young, the person. I love some of the things he does. I think it's a really hard thing for him to be drafted that high. And then you turn the reins over to him, and I think he'll get exposed before he's ready. I take it you disagree.
Well, to an extent, Doug, let me explain why. When you're looking at the way the NBA has trended over the years, the dominant skilled player is the point guard position. So when you look at Trae Young, he possesses all the ability that you will need to enhance your franchise, the long-distance shooting, the great ball handling, the pinpoint passing, the ability to read and think on the fly from the ball screen. Those are all characteristics that you need from the point guard position. So you can take guys like a Chris Paul or what have you, and look at Trae Young, and he possessed some of those same type of abilities.
I just don't think he has the burst to get by people, and I think he's little. I think he struggles to finish in the lane, and I don't think he guards anybody. I do think he has the passing. I do think he can make open shots. I just think it's hard to see him getting open shots, especially if he can't guard anybody at the other end.
Well, defensively, I do see that he'll be a bit challenged, and a lot has to do with his age. I mean, we're talking about a 19-year-old kid that hasn't really done a chin-up yet, Doug. Yep. So he hasn't really touched the weight yet, but I think over time, that side of the ball he'll develop. And I think reps, he has to get the repetitions with training camp, with summer league, with some weight training. I believe over time, the defensive part will come. I think during the year, he did a lot of resting on the defensive side of the ball. So a lot of it was effort to me. So some of those things can be fixed over time, and I believe Trae Young will overcome those characteristics that we don't think he has.
That's interesting. DeAndre Ayton reminds you of Ralph Sampson. Why?
When you go back to 1983 and you look at the tape, Ralph Sampson was one of those unicorns. He was a guy that was 7'3", that was able to run the floor. He was something that we hadn't really seen before over time. And when you go to the tape and look at DeAndre's tape, you're looking at a specimen outside of a basketball player. I think DeAndre Ayton is a specimen. His ability to run the floor faster than anybody else, even though being the biggest guy on the court, the way he scores around the basket, just has a lot of Ralph Sampson type of qualities. And when I was able to look at the statistics and dig deeper, it showed me that it was almost dead on their statistics from college.
Okay, let's pose this question, though. Bagley, yes, or Ayton, you can only pick one, top of the draft. Who do you take?
I'm going to take Ayton for the fact that I believe that Ayton's a better defender. Marvin Bagley is highly skilled, but I still think that there's some things to address on the defensive side of the ball, and he still hasn't picked up how to read out of the post defense yet. When you post double Marvin Bagley, he struggles out of the post. I think Ayton's a little bit better offensively in recognizing situations and making guys around him a little better.
I take Bagley just because I think Bagley, you know, can handle the ball. Mm-hmm. He's more versatile at both ends, even if he's not as good at anything around the basket as Ayton is. But I think it's going to be a fascinating draft. Okay, give me a sleeper. Okay, you love guys. You find guys that other people miss on. Give me one sleeper the world has not heard of that will be drafted, that will make the NBA.
Well, that's pretty easy for me. If you look at Wofford's Fletcher McGee, I believe Fletcher McGee from Wofford is the best shooting guard in the country that nobody's talking about. We're talking about a kid that led the country in three-point made this season at 148. He's a better three-point shooter than Jimmer Fredette and J.J. Redick coming out of college, statistically proven, and those guys were lottery picks. And this kid, Fletcher McGee, is not even showing up on draft boards right now, but he's 6'4.5". He's a little bigger than J.J. Redick. He has a quicker release. He's stronger. And this kid has performed against Power 5 conferences, 36 against California, 27 against North Carolina on TV. He's a 90% free throw shooter. So I think this kid epitomizes what the NBA shooting guard is. Fletcher McGee, Wofford University.
Great. Good call. I know you called that before the start of the season, and he lit up North Carolina, and you were doing some padding on the back, and now you're going to do some padding on the back when he gets drafted. Of course, he declared for the NBA draft. Rashad, we'll do this again. I'll be on your digital show whenever you want. Appreciate you appearing on my podcast. That concludes the All Ball Podcast, a great part of the Herd Podcast Network. Hope you enjoyed Porter Mosier, Bill Self, and my man Rashad Phillips. We'll have more for you from San Antonio upcoming. Tell your friends. Don't be afraid to retweet. Send this out and say, hey, it's a good listen. Thanks for downloading the All Ball Podcast. I'm Doug Gottlieb.